So this is a very famous quote that, again, talks about this emphasis on your own efforts. It is up to you to make strong effort. Buddhas merely tell you how. So now I want to read you. So I like this text a lot. However, that's how to say this. Maybe say it differently. I love the text. I don't necessarily always like it. It's like, you know, being in an intimate relationship with someone, you know, and you know, you love them, but but there are these difficulties. So, you know, this text, you know, I find it also challenging. Sometimes I don't know if I like some of the verses, or I don't know what it's, you know, what it's about. I believe that the text was meant to challenge these people who felt it was the sense of urgency and don't waste time and apply yourself and do what's essential. They're kind of like, the text is offering a challenge. Challenging us to practice, but also challenging some of our most cherished beliefs, cherished ideas and identities and attachments. And so some of the text, you know, if you don't feel challenged by a text, then the text is not doing its work. If it's just kind of very nice and poetic and inspiring and feel really good by the time we finished, then I think from the point of view of the people who compiled this text, the text has failed. Some of it certainly can be inspiring, but I think it's, you know, it's really meant to be a challenging text. Some of the English translations that exist are not translations at all, but renditions. Some of the most popular, at least sold books in English, of the Dhammapada, the people didn't know any Pali at all. But they looked at existing English translations and then came with their own. And one of them, I think one of the most best-selling ones out there, I think is really beautiful. And I'm inspired when I read it. But I know that it's not the teachings of the Buddha. You know, it's the, you know. And so one of the things I tried to do in translating this text is to the best that it was possible, I really wanted to hear the voices, the original voices, the original teachings. I didn't want my preferences to get in the way. And, you know, it's hard to kind of avoid that entirely. But I really wanted to try the best I could out of respect for those ancient Buddhists who are our ancestors, in a sense. I really wanted their voices to come forth and speak for themselves. And if I didn't like what the verse said, I wasn't going to twist it so I liked it. I really wanted to kind of let it come up. So the text is to challenge us. So here are some challenging verses. Having killed mother, father, two warrior kings, a kingdom and its subjects, the Brahmin, undisturbed, moves on. Here the Brahmin is kind of supposed to meant synonymous with the person who's enlightened. Well, that's what it takes. But then to say that again, it says, having killed mother, father, two learned kings, and a tiger, the Brahmin, undisturbed, moves on. Well, what's a tiger doing there? Right? These are metaphors. So you have to understand it that way. But it's first, you know, he had this, gee, what's that about? So each of these are symbolic for something else. And I think that it's great to have footnotes because then you find out what you know. If it's your footnotes, I guess. Mother, so according to the commentaries, mother refers to craving and father to conceit. Two warrior kings to the metaphysical views of eternalism and annihilationism. The kingdom to the 12 sense spheres, and the subjects of the kingdom to the passion for pleasure. And the tiger, this has some kind of reference to the five hindrances. Then there's one verse that, so I told you how I tried to be literal best I could, and try to capture. Well, there's one verse that, if I can, here it is. So, this is what the verse literally says. And I put it in the literal translation. In the end notes, tucked away, it's kind of small print. The person who is without faith and gratitude, who breaks into homes, who has destroyed opportunities, and who has vomited, is an audacious person, or perhaps is the ultimate servant. What's that? About strange language. This is how I translated it. The person who has gone beyond faith knows the unmade, has severed the link, destroyed the potential for rebirth, and eliminated clinging is the ultimate person. What do you think of that? Have I just done one of those kind of, you know, modern American things of making it kind of nice? You know, because it didn't quite fit my view of things. And you know, Buddha couldn't have said that. And certainly the Buddha was, you know, like, you know, he was probably, you know, from California, right? So I'm sure he meant that. It's verse 97. Now, the thing about this translation is that this particular verse was made up of puns, word puns. And so because of the word pun, you can translate it either way. And I think it was meant to, again, be challenging or shocking to the person when they first heard it. You know, what? Breaking into homes? Vomiting? You know, what's that about? But it's a wordplay. And so I debated a lot which to put it in the body of the text, play the wordplay play, which direction to take it. And partly with advice from others, I was convinced to put the most literal meaning in the footnotes and the wordplay kind of meaning in the body of the text. So I think a text is meant to be challenging. And here's a challenging text, verse. At least maybe it's challenging. Some people will read this text and come to the conclusion that it's world-denying, world-negating. It's reasonable to come to that conclusion because some of the English translations translate it that way. And I think, now we can debate forever about who's right here, right? But I think that many people who have translated into English along those lines, it's their own bias that comes through, not the original. But even so, here's one that could be seen as being world-denying or negating. Or do not follow an inferior way. Don't live with negligence. Do not follow a wrong view. Don't be engrossed in the world. Don't be engrossed in the world. That could sound like somehow, you know, don't be involved with the world. But engrossed is meant to be a strong word. Engrossed means somehow captivated by the world or enchanted by the world or infatuated or lost in the world in the way that people can be. So don't get lost in the world, is what it says here. But that can, you know, some people will kind of be startled by that. Don't be engrossed in the world. But then there's this one. Affection gives rise to grief. Affection gives rise to fear. For someone released from affection, there is no grief. And from where would come fear? What do you think of that? What's wrong with affection? Isn't that disturbing? So again, the text is challenging us. You know, so okay. So you could just throw away the book now. Get your money back and say, that's not for me. what's this kind of negating the value of affection? It's so basic to human life. And now I'm convinced these Buddhists are world denying. They're kind of these celibate monks who are uptight and kind of. Affection gives rise to grief. For someone released from affection, who wants that? So, part of the opportunity in a text like this is then to grapple with that. And I think part of the function of a good spiritual text is a text that we have to grapple with, that we have to struggle with. And it doesn't give easy answers always, but rather, what's going on and why does he say this? Do we just dismiss it offhand, or do we engage it and debate it and debate with our friends about what it says there? So I've done that with this verse. And I could tell you who won the debate, or I could leave it to you to do the debate on your own. So the text has a lot of verses which are not evolved and developed teachings, but are very kind of pithy kind of challenges to think about or think about things a new way. Here's another one. If by giving up a lesser happiness one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. I find that a very interesting teaching. And I spent a lot of time reflecting on that particular verse. What does that mean? Is that really true? And what's that about? And what's this pursuit of happiness all about? And, you know, going from one happiness to a better one, is that hedonistic? These Buddhist hedonists? Just going for happiness? So, I mean, I could certainly give whole teachings, a lot of interpretations of this, but maybe it's better just to leave it hanging. And you guys, this, you know, it's an example of a verse that is to be engaged with. And so, you know, I've spent whole days, you know, with one verse kind of going through my mind and reflecting on it, thinking about it, and living with it. It comes back at different times, because I'm familiar now with this text. The verses come back into my mind at different times, and I feel my life has been enriched by having these verses come bubble up in my mind and offer a different perspective or idea. Sometimes I'll just pick up the book and just see what hits my eye, what verses hit my eye, and what that speaks to me for any given day. And one of the interesting things about translating the text is that, you know, you translate it verse by verse, and each verse, you know, kind of lost in the world of each verse, kind of. And it wasn't until I finished it that I started to have an overall view of the whole text, and even more so once the publisher sent me the copy of the book. And because somehow in the book form, it kind of got I felt I can get an overview in a way I couldn't when I was there verse by verse. And so I still find it very interesting. It's still opening up for me and interesting for me to look and read it. A few more things I'll say is that not only is this book unique, or almost unique, in its kind of uncompromising message of self-reliance, it also seems to me pretty unique in the history, in the collection of sacred literature in the world, to be metaphysically light. There's almost no metaphysics. Some people could argue none, but I think there's a little bit, but almost none. The metaphysics seems almost not necessary as you read this. And, you know, you look at the chapter titles, you know, just looking at the titles already begins telling you something about, you know, what the emphasis is. Vigilance, the mind, the fool, the sage, the arhat, evil, violence, old age, oneself, the world, the Buddha, happiness, the deer, anger, corruption, the just, the path, the elephant, craving, the bhikkhu, the Brahman. It kind of gives you, you know, it's not talking about, you know, cosmic consciousness or, you know, some metaphysical principles. It's talking about something that's very basic, pretty basic, pretty immediate, something we can experience, something that's part of our ordinary life, I think. This is not a message that takes us, I think it takes us out of our life into some reality outside, but for me it's a message that takes us into a capacity for very, very deep peace, very deep sense of deep peace, well-being, freedom of heart, freedom of mind, that I hope is contagious, that I hope is something that spreads out to others. And that freedom that this text that is pointing to is basically never talked about in affirmative ways or positive ways. It doesn't describe what that is like, except that it's freedom. How it describes, what are the descriptions of it are over and over again in negative terms, what you're freed from. Because, you know, if you need freedom, it means that you're enslaved or in prison or in shackles or something, right? And so it talks about being freed from those shackles or freed from those prisons. And so the kind of prisons that or shackles that the text emphasizes is free of death, which is a very interesting thing. Why does it say that? And certainly the Buddha died, so how could he have said free from death? Free from bonds, fetters or shackles, from conceit, from craving, from fear, from obsessive thinking, from the toxins, the toxic emotions, from suffering, and from mental defilements. And then you might ask, why this emphasis on defining freedom from what is lacking, what's absent? And I argue in the introduction that for two basic reasons. One is that maybe freedom, the experience of liberation, cannot be described through a normal language and normal words. And so it's better not to try to talk about what you can't talk about. Perhaps if you try to say what it is, then people will latch onto it, that idea. So if you don't tell them what it is, then, you know, it's harder to latch on, to get attached. But also maybe, and this is, again, I don't know if this is true, but it's something to reflect. Maybe freedom is not one thing. As when someone is, if two people are released from prison on the same day, their experience of the doors opening up and stepping free from the prison is the same. But what they do with that freedom can be widely different from each other. The experience of freedom, once they have it, can be very different depending on what they do. So in the same way, when we have stepped out of those things that keep our hearts, our minds, bound by fear, by hatred, by confusion, by ambition, by obsessive thinking, and we step into that empty field, the signless field of freedom, it's up to us how we live our lives. And we can live it in many different ways, each of us in our own ways. But we live then with freedom. And it's my belief that one of the greatest gifts we can give the world is that freedom. And my hope is that it's contagious. So that's some thoughts about the text. Maybe if you have a few questions you'd like to ask before we stop, and I can sign some books if you'd like. Any questions? Comments? Protests? Why did I choose the word vigilance instead of other choices for the word appamada? Actually, for a long time, I had translated it as attentiveness. I really like that. But in the end, I was convinced that it wasn't really right for the word appamada. The reason I like attentiveness is that it's very close to the word attention, and somehow attention is the path to the deathless, something about the nature of attention or awareness in and of itself. But the meaning of the word is a certain kind of heightened watchfulness, heightened alertness, vigilance works for that. You're vigilant, you're being attentive. There's a danger. There's a danger, and so you're vigilant, you're careful. So heedful is another word. Someone who is pamada, someone who is, I translate, there's two words, or this pamada, which means heedless or negligent, and lacking that kind of, and there's apamada, which is vigilant. And And it just seemed to me that the vigilance had just the right balance of awareness, alertness, watchfulness, mindfulness, and also a sense of energy, being energetic in that endeavor, and also a sense of urgency. And I felt that captured the spirit of this text the best. Oh yes. Oh yeah. So Dhammapada, we don't know exactly when it was compiled. Sometimes it's claimed that these are the words of the Buddha, and chances are most of them are, but I don't think we can say that they all are. In fact, I mean, there's no internal evidence. The majority of the verses, there's no evidence that they're spoken by the Buddha. The tradition claims it is. But there is evidence that some of the verses were probably spoken by other people. There is evidence for that. And so I talk about that a little bit in the end notes, I think. And so sometime, probably, could have been during the time of the Buddha's life, or maybe after he died, there was an interest in beginning to making these anthologies of verses. And there are many people who did that, because there is a genre of literature called the Dharmapada genre. It's a collection, and use a Sanskrit word, Dharmapada, that are, there's other collections like this of Buddhist verses. Some of them are a lot longer, like one of them has about 1,000 verses. They share a lot of the same verses, but then some of the collections have other verses in them, and the arrangement is different, how they're arranged within, you know, the first verses in this text happen, you know, halfway through the other collection. This is the only one that survives in Pali. There's some that survive in other languages, Tibetan, Chinese, Gandhari, Sanskrit, different things. And no one knows which one is the original one, but the assumption is that they're all influencing each other. And so the Ur text, the original, no one knows what it is. But by the time these were written down and codified, it already represents a developed tradition. At some point, probably about... anywhere between 500 and 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha, people started making commentaries about this text. And there's two kinds of commentaries that I know of. One is kind of a word-by-word commentary that actually talks about the words, what they mean. And some of the words are very hard to understand what some of the words mean. And so they kind of explain the words and the meaning. And they help to some degree. However, sometimes because they're a later Buddhist tradition, some of the orthodox later ideas are interpreted back into the text. So you have to be a little cautious when you read the commentary. And then the other kind of commentary is, and it's not exactly a commentary, but they'll give one verse, and then they'll tell the story for when the Buddha taught that verse. And every verse has a story of when the Buddha said that verse. Now, these are apocryphal stories. They were made up probably 1,000 years after the Buddha. But they're supposed to illustrate why this verse came to be. And so there's those two kinds of commentary. And both commentaries have been translated into English.
Gil, I'm interested in how you learn Pali. Would you like to tell us was it an academic pursuit at Stanford, or did you do it in Southeast Asia, or both? Taking years and years to be able to make these discriminations between already existing translations.
I studied Sanskrit at the university. I studied it in graduate school, and I didn't study a lot of it, so I didn't become fluent, for example. But I got the basics of the grammar of Sanskrit. And Pali is a simplified form of Sanskrit. If you know Sanskrit, it's relatively easy to read Pali. If you know Pali, it's hard to read Sanskrit because of that direction. It's kind of like, you know, maybe it's not completely the same, but if you have, you know, Latin and then you have Italian, you know, it's like the languages evolve over time. So Pali can be seen as a simplified form of Sanskrit. So I studied Sanskrit. And then And so I knew the grammar, I knew kind of the structure of the language a little bit, enough. And then I had to rely a lot on dictionaries. I tried to be really careful. So it was a really slow process to do this because I'm not fluent. I don't have the history of knowing Pali well enough. And ideally you would have read lots and lots of Pali texts and lots of the originals for years, and before you are so presumptuous as to translate. But I jumped in. And so I had to use the dictionary a lot, and I had to use my understanding of the grammar. I had to go back to the grammar book sometimes to understand the subtleties that existed. There were times which I had to ask other people for help, and I asked other people who knew Pali a lot better than me for help. My goal was to do a translation that would not rise the eyebrows of any Pali scholar. What I know now is four people who know Pali well have looked at it. And as far as I know, I've seen no eyebrows go up. So that was... What? Yeah, I think Tan Jeff, who many of you know, Tanisra Bhikkhu, I think he wasn't so happy with it, but he didn't veto it. There were other things in the translation which he felt much stronger about that I should change. And I would listen to him, and we would have these debates. And sometimes I listened to him, and sometimes I thought he was wrong. And once, he has a translation also. That's pretty good. But I was very pleased that once, in one verse, he went back and changed his after seeing mine. And I did a translation, basically, one verse at a time. What happened was that I was kind of prompted to do it by the publisher. I wasn't thinking of doing it. They kind of were asking for someone to do it, and I said, "Well, I should look at." I wasn't thinking of doing it, but I'll just look at it, and I'll look at the Pali. And I started one evening, kind of just translating, and it was kind of fun to translate. That was kind of nice, and so I kept it up a little bit. And then it was a time when my first son was very hard to put to sleep at night, and so he required someone to kind of be with him until he fell asleep, and it took a long time. Of course, it was a trip. And primarily my wife would do that, and she would often fall asleep with him. So I had all these evenings. you do one or two verses an evening, and you have a lot of evenings, eventually you finish. So that's how it came to be. Yes?
I do translations too, and I know how very difficult it is. And there's a saying the Italians say, traduttore traditore, which means translator traitor. And I feel that you haven't been a traitor to this text, and it just reads beautifully, and I want to thank you.
Well, I try to be honest in the sense that if there were any questions or controversy about how I translated, I tried to say that in the end notes. So I'm not trying to do a fast one over the reader. For people who know, if there's a question, go to the end notes and there's some explanation there. If minimum, I'll give the Pali, so you can go and get your Pali dictionary. Yes?
What is the proper pronunciation of the title, and why are we using it?
Dhammapada?
Because Richard Sankey says it's Dhammapada.
Yeah, someone said there are different ways of pronouncing Pali depending on which country you're in, so it could be a difference like that. So my understanding is Dhammapada, but it has to be Dhammapada. Because it's two words, it's Dhamma and Pada, and so you would pronounce it Dhamma Pada. I don't think the compound changes that, the way the syllables are broken up. Yeah.
What is a rendition? I've never
heard. Oh, a rendition. Yeah, translation is where you go back to the original, and you're translating directly from the. Rendition is a creative rendering. Like Timothy Leary, he did a rendition of the Tao Te Ching. It was called something like the psychedelic Tao Te Ching or something. And what he did was he went and got half a dozen English translations of the Tao Te Ching, went to Nepal, would read like one chapter or one verse or something, then drop acid. And then he would make his rendition. And you know, so it's kind of like doing jazz off it. You know, you kind of just rip, and so. Yeah, and so sometimes people take a lot of creative license, and so the one that I like actually a lot is the one by Thomas Byron, and I think it's actually quite beautiful, the way he's done a great job, but and it's elegant, and I'm inspired by some of the things I read there, but you know, there's no way that's what the Buddha taught. I mean, sometimes it's kind of close, sometimes it's wildly off. I don't know what he was on. But I don't think he knew Pali. I think he found an English translation and was somehow found his inspiration as a poet and kind of worked off it to do something new. So. Thank you. Well, it would be nice if some of you, you know, would read it, and if you found it meaningful, or at least found it a worthy debater, worthy opponent, where you can, worthy place to be challenged. And I don't know who will win your debate, but if you find it worthy to have engaged in debate with the text and the teachings of the text, and that it's a worthy thing to do. So many thanks for coming. I feel honored that you've come to this little inauguration of the text. And I'm happy to sign copies if people have copies. And I had no idea. We had no idea so many people were going to come. I didn't, at least. So I actually talked Inez into getting fewer copies. I couldn't believe that it was. So I don't know if there's any more back there, but I apologize for. What?
There's five.
So thank you very much.